Mao rarely attended the meetings, following them instead through written reports compiled every evening. He was in retreat, strategically withholding judgment and finding out where his colleagues stood. But the chairman was not pleased. Letting off steam with his doctor, Li Jisui, he said, "All the good party members are dead. The only ones left are a bunch of zombies." But he took no action. At last, party leaders started to discuss among themselves the extent of the damage done by 3 years of forced collectivization. What they discovered was destruction on a scale few could have imagined. Part 3. Destruction. Chapter 17. Agriculture. The term command economy comes from the German Befelswirtschaft. It was originally applied to the Nazi economy, but was later used to describe the Soviet Union. Instead of allowing dispersed buyers and sellers to determine their own economic activities according to the laws of supply and demand, a higher authority would issue commands determining the overall direction of the economy following a master plan. The command principle entailed that all economic decisions were centralized for the greater good, as the state determined what should be produced, how much should be produced, who produced what and where, how resources should be allocated, and what prices should be charged for materials, goods, and services. A central plan replaced the market. As planners took over the economy in China, farmers lost control over the harvest. In 1953, a monopoly over grain was introduced, decreeing that farmers must sell all surplus grain to the state at prices determined by the state. The aim behind the monopoly was to stabilize the price of grain across the country, eliminate speculation, and guarantee the grain needed to feed the urban population and fuel an industrial expansion. But what was surplus grain in a country where many farmers barely grew enough to scrape by? It was defined as seed, fodder, and a basic grain ration set at roughly 13 to 15 kilos per head each month. However, 23 to 26 kilos of unhusked grain were required to provide 1,700 to 1,900 calories per day, an amount international aid organizations consider to be the bare minimum for subsistence. The notion of a surplus, in other words, was a political construct designed to give legitimacy to the extraction of grain from the countryside. By forcing villagers to sell grain before their own subsistence needs were met, the state also made them more dependent on the collective. Extra grain above the basic ration had to be bought back from the state by villagers with work points, which were distributed on the basis of their performance in collective labor. Farmers had lost control not only of their land and their harvest, but also of their own work schedules. Local cadres determined who should do what and for how many work points, from collecting manure to looking after the buffaloes in the fields. As the market was eliminated and money lost its purchasing power, grain became the currency of exchange. Most of it was in the hands of the state. But a more insidious problem lurked behind the notion of a grain surplus, namely the enormous pressure applied to local leaders to pledge ever greater grain sales. The amount sold to the state was determined in a series of meetings which started from the village up, as a team leader passed on a quota to the brigade, where the pledges were adjusted and collated into a bid passed on to the commune, which then negotiated how much it would deliver to the county. By the time a pledge reached the level of the region and the province, the amount had been revised upwards several times as a result of peer pressure. A figure very far removed from reality finally landed on the desk of Li Fuchun, the man responsible for planning the economy and setting national production targets. He, in turn, inflated the target according to the latest policy shifts agreed on by the leadership. That new figure was the party's command. The pressure to show sensational gains in grain output reached a climax during the Great Leap Forward. In a frenzy of competitive bidding, party officials from the village all the way up to the province tried to outdo each other, as one record after the other was announced by the propaganda machine, in turn spurring even more cautious carders to inflate the figures. Even after the party had tried to rein in some of the more extravagant claims in early 1959, failure to project a substantial leap in output was interpreted as rightist conservatism, in particular during the purges which followed the Lushan plenum. In a climate of fear, village leaders followed orders rather than try to haggle over quotas. More often than not, a party secretary or deputy from the commune would simply drive up to a strip of land, have a look around, and casually determine the target yield. A team leader explained the process as follows. In 1960, we were given a quota of 260 tons. This was increased by 5.5 tons a few days later. Then the commune held a meeting and added a further 25 tons. After 2 days, the commune phoned us to say that the quota had gone up to 315 tons. How this all happened, we have no idea. The higher the office, the greater the power to increase the quota, which had repercussions for every subordinate unit, and each had to juggle the figures to comply. When Si Fuzi, the boss in Yunnan, was told by Beijing that the national target for grain output had been raised to 300 million tons, he immediately convened a telephone conference to explain to county leaders that this really meant 350 to 400 million tons. Yunnan, he rapidly calculated, contained about 1/30th of the total population, meaning a share of 10 million tons. Since Yunnan did not want to trail behind the rest of the country, Si raised this to a nicely rounded total of 25 billion jin, equivalent to 12.5 million tons. Everybody from the region down to the county, commune, brigade and village had to scramble and adjust the local quotas accordingly. With inflated crops came procurement quotas which were far too high, leading to shortages and outright famine. But if the figures were made up, how do we know what the real crop was and what proportion of the harvest was procured by the state? Kenneth Walker, a specialist in agrarian economics at the University of London, spent a decade painstakingly assembling statistical data from a whole range of local newspapers, published statistics, and policy guidelines. He showed that the state imposed the highest levies in 1959 to 1962, at a time when the average output per head was actually at its lowest. Just as his study appeared in print in 1984, a statistical yearbook was published by the National Statistical Bureau in China, with a set of historical data covering the famine years. Most observers have relied on these official figures. But why should we trust a set of statistics published by a party notoriously protective of its own past? Problems with the official statistics appeared when Yang Zisheng, a retired journalist from the Xinhua agency, published a book on the famine based on party archives. He relied on a set of figures compiled in 1962 by the Bureau for Grain. But this merely transferred the problem from one set of numbers to another. The fact that a document comes from an archive does not automatically make it right. Every archive has a series of competing figures put together in different ways by different agencies at different times. As a result of political pressure, the statistical work of the Bureau for Grain disintegrated from 1958 to 1962 to such an extent that the state itself could no longer calculate a realistic level of grain production. And the distortion was at its greatest at the very top, as false reporting and inflated claims accumulated on their way up the party hierarchy. If the leaders themselves were lost in a morass of statistical invention, It seems unlikely that we can magically extract the numerical truth from a single document in the party archives. Mao Zedong, Liu Shaoqi, Deng Xiaoping, and other leaders knew all too well that they were looking at the world through layers of distorted filters, and their solution was to spend more time investigating what happened on the ground in field trips to the countryside. On the other hand, between 1962 and 1965, local statistical bureaus tried to rebuild their credibility and often went back to the years of famine to find out what had happened. The figures they produced indicate a much higher degree of procurement than those provided by the Bureau for Grain. Table 5 compares the figures compiled by the Bureau in 1962 with the local numbers calculated in 1965 by the Provincial Office for Statistics in Hunan, in an attempt to determine how much farmers had actually contributed to the state. The difference in estimates for the grain output is minimal, but when it comes to the size of the levies, the figures provided by the province turn out to be much higher, ranging from 28 to 35% of the total harvest. Why is there a discrepancy of 4 to 10%? One reason can be found in the nature of the statistical evidence. Closer scrutiny indicates that the figures provided by the Bureau for Grain were not carefully reconstructed in the aftermath of the famine, but rather mechanically compiled from the plans the Bureau had handed out in the previous years. Each plan had two sets of numbers, one set indicating the procurements actually realized in the current year, the other setting targets for the coming year. The procurement figures given for 1958, for instance, come from the plan for 1959, meaning that they were rough approximations. To this we should add the fact that the Bureau for Grain in Beijing was under much pressure in 1962 to show that it had not allowed excessive procurements to drain the countryside of grain, and would thus have adopted a set of low figures. But there is another reason for the mismatch. At every level of society, from the village and the commune up to the province, grain was being hidden. The figures compiled in 1965 by the Office for Statistics in Hunan were based on careful research after the famine. The office could go back to whole sets of commune and county statistics to find out how much had actually been procured, in contrast to the numbers the province officially handed over to the centre. The discrepancy, in other words, corresponds to the amount of procured grain which escaped the gaze of the state. Other examples confirm that the rates of procurement were much higher than those suggested by the Bureau for Grain. In Zhejiang, for instance, Zheng Xiaowen, a top provincial official, admitted in 1961 that some 2.9 million tons, or 40.9% of the harvest, was procured in 1958, followed by an even larger 43.2% in the following year. The Bureau for Grain gives much lower percentages, namely 30.4% for 1958, followed by 34.4%. A similar story comes from Guizhou in the provincial archives, which Yang Zicheng was unable to access. A document from the Provincial Party Committee shows that an average of 1.8 million tons was procured each year from 1958 to 1960, meaning 44.4%, with a peak of 2.34 million tons in 1959, equivalent to an enormous 56.5% of the crop. The figures given by the Bureau for Grain are on average 1.4 million tons for the same 3 years, or about a quarter less. Some of these calculations may seem rather abstract, but they matter a great deal. Grain is not only the currency of exchange in a command economy, it becomes the source of survival in times of famine. When either Hunan or Zhejiang increased their procurements by 8 to 10%, taking an extra 750,000 tons of grain from the countryside in the middle of the famine, the number of people forced into starvation grew proportionally. We have seen how 1 kilo of grain provided a sufficient number of calories for one person each day, meaning that a family of three could live on a ton per year. But the real point is that many farmers could have survived famine if their rations had been only marginally increased by some 400 or 500 calories a day, equivalent to a large bowl in the evening. In short, in order to understand how people perished on such a scale, it is vital to see the role played by increased procurements in times of declining harvests. How much grain was procured overall? No one set of true numbers will ever be discovered in the archives, since every figure was a statement bound by politics and expediency rather than by expertise. But it seems that the Bureau for Grain compiled figures which were far below both what foreign observers managed to calculate on the basis of published regional statistics and what the Bureau for Statistics compiled in 1962. In short, evidence from different sources shows that the level of procurement varied from 30 to 37% nationally, far above the more usual 20 to 25% extracted up to 1958. As Mao had indicated on the 25th of March 1959 at a secret gathering of party leaders, "If you don't go above a third, people won't rebel." He himself encouraged much greater procurements than usual, at a time when it was well known that the crop figures had been inflated. In other words, the idea that the state mistakenly took too much grain from the countryside because it assumed that the harvest was much bigger than it was is largely a myth, at most partially true for the autumn of 1958 only. A proportion of the procured grain was sold back to the farmers, at a premium, but they were at the end of a long waiting list. As we have seen in chapters 10 and 15, the party had evolved a set of political priorities which ignored the needs of the countryside. The leadership decided to increase grain exports to honour its foreign contracts and maintain its international reputation to such an extent that a policy of export above all else was adopted in 1960. It chose to increase its foreign aid to its allies, shipping grain for free to countries like Albania. Priority was also given to the growing populations of Beijing, Tianjin, Shanghai, and the province of Liaoning, the heartland of heavy industry, followed by the requirements of city people in general. The consequence of these political decisions was not only an increase in the proportion of procurements, but also an increase in the overall amount of grain handed over to the state out of these procurements. In the case of Zhejiang, for instance, an annual average of 1.68 million tons left the province from 1958 to 1961, in contrast to 1.2 million tons in each of the preceding 3 years. In 1958 alone, that meant that more than half of the procured grain was handed over to Beijing even before the province started to feed its urban residents. Overall, the amount of grain taken out of the procurements by the state to feed Beijing, Shanghai, Tianjin, and Liaoning province and maintain its export market went up every single quarter, from 1.6 million tons in the third quarter of 1956 to 1.8 million tons in the same period in 1957, to 2.3 million tons in 1958, to 2.5 million tons a year later, and to a high of 3 million tons in 3 months in 1960. The net effect of these policy priorities was that the lives of many villagers were destroyed. As Wang Renzong put it in a meeting of the leaders of all southern provinces in August 1961, "Extraordinarily difficult conditions demand extraordinary measures," explaining that grain could be provided only to the cities, so that villages in the grip of famine would have to fend for themselves. As he saw it, some of the parts had to be sacrificed in order to keep the whole. He was not alone. Zhou Enlai, for one, was relentless in pushing for greater requisitions. He was the man in charge of making sure that enough grain was taken from the countryside to feed the cities and earn foreign currency. He badgered provincial bosses in person, over the phone, through his deputies, and in a ceaseless string of telegrams marked urgent. He too had a keen sense of hierarchy in which the needs of the countryside had to give way to the interests of the state, which he represented. He knew full well that the vast amounts of grain he was given by Li Jingquan, a radical follower of Mao, could lead only to a situation of mass famine in Sichuan. But others, too, clung rigidly to the view that the starvation of the people mattered less than the demands of the state. Deng Xiaoping thought that in the command economy, requisitions had to be enforced ruthlessly, as if in a war. No matter how much a provincial leader tried to defend his turf, the party line had to be held, or the state would perish. Speaking at the end of 1961, when the extent of the famine was well known among the leadership, this is what Deng Xiaoping had to say about Sichuan, where huge requisitions caused the deaths of many millions of people. In the past, procurements have been too heavy in some regions, for instance in Sichuan, where they have been heavy for quite a few years, including this year. But there was no alternative. I approve of the Sichuan style. They never moan about hardship. We should all learn from Sichuan. And I am not saying this because I myself am from Sichuan. As we have seen, Mao phrased it differently. When there is not enough to eat, people starve to death. It is better to let half of the people die so that the other half can eat their fill. The procurement prices paid by the state for grain varied from province to province. In the case of maize, for instance, it ranged from 124 yuan per ton in Guangxi to 152 yuan just across the border in Guangdong in early 1961. The difference for rice could be up to 50%. For instance, 124 yuan per ton in Guangxi versus 180 yuan for the same quantity in Shanghai. The state made a substantial profit by exporting rice for 400 yuan per ton. These prices were periodically adjusted, but the procurement prices remained so low that more often than not, farmers produced grain at a loss. As late as 1976, it was unprofitable simply for that reason to cultivate wheat, barley, maize, and sorghum. The income on rice was marginal. But in a command economy, farmers no longer decided for themselves which crop they could grow, as they had to follow the orders of local cadres instead, who in turn had to apply the commands of the party. And the planners were transfixed by grain output, deciding to force an ever greater proportion of farmers to concentrate on grain, to the detriment of the overall economy. This vision was translated in 1959 into a policy of encouraging grain production above all else, leaving many provinces to extend the surface cultivated with grain by some 10%. Farmers who were asked to abandon more remunerative crops for maize, rice, or wheat lost out. For instance, after some villages in Zhejiang were told to grow grain instead of the melons, sugarcane, and tobacco they had habitually cultivated, they saw their income plunge. Another problem with the command economy was that officials on the ground did not always know what they were doing, and they imposed decisions which turned out to be disastrous. We have already seen how close cropping and deep ploughing were insisted on by the regime at the height of the Great Leap Forward. This was compounded by capricious interventions by local cadres with little knowledge of agriculture. In 1959, in Luokang Commune, a local leader decided to replace the existing crop with sweet potatoes on half of the available acreage, only to change his mind later and substitute the potatoes with peanuts. These were then torn out to make room for rice instead. The previous year, the commune had tried deep ploughing, using vast concentrations of manpower on small strips of land to dig deep furrows, much of it by hand. huge amounts of fertilizer were applied, in some cases up to 30 tons a hectare. It all came to nothing. In Kaiping County, Guangdong, thousands of villagers were repeatedly forced to plant a crop in the early spring of 1959, despite bitterly cold weather. The seeds froze on three occasions, and in the end, fields yielded a paltry 450 kilos per hectare. But even more disastrous was the command to plant less. Mao was so convinced that the countryside was heaving under the weight of grain that he suggested that a third of the land be allowed to lie fallow. People in China, on average, cultivate 3 mu, but I think that 2 mu is enough. Combined with an exodus of farmers towards the cities, the overall acreage under cultivation plummeted. In Hunan in 1958, some 5.78 million hectares were cultivated with grain, but by 1962 this was down by 15% to 4.92 million hectares. In Zhejiang province, some 65,000 hectares of cultivated land vanished every year, leading to a loss of about a tenth of the total acreage by 1961. These provincial averages masked deep regional differences. In the Wuhan region, for instance, just over half of the available 37,000 hectares were tilled. Tan Junlin, the man in charge of agriculture, noted in 1959 that some 7.3 million hectares were allowed to lie fallow. Speaking in early 1961, Peng Jin estimated that the total sown area stood at 107 million hectares. If true, this would have meant a waste of 23 million hectares since 1958. To this loss had to be added a change in the proportion of grains grown. The urban population much preferred fine grains, rice, wheat, soybeans, although in the north considerable amounts of coarse grain, sorghum, maize and millet, were also consumed. But sweet potatoes were regarded as peasant fare and were not generally eaten in significant amounts. Sweet potatoes, moreover, were a perishable commodity, meaning that the state had a limited interest in them. Most of the procurements were in fine grains. But the proportion of sweet potatoes grew during the years of famine, as Cardis responded to pressure to increase the yield by switching to the tuber, which was easy to cultivate. More often than not, farmers were left with potatoes only. By imposing a monopoly on the sale of grain, the state undertook a task of mammoth proportions. State employees had to buy the grain, store it, transport it to different destinations across the country, store it again, and distribute it against ration coupons, all according to a master plan rather than the incentives created by the market. Even a wealthy country might have balked at the immensity of the task, but China was a poor nation, and a very large one at that. State storage, as opposed to small inventories distributed across a wide range of private and public producers, retailers and consumers, contributed in no small measure to the destruction of grain. Insects were common, rats abounded. A detailed investigation by the Guangdong Provincial People's Congress showed that in Nanxiong County, an astonishing 2,533 of all 2,832 local granaries had rats. Insects infested a third of all 123 state granaries, and an even larger proportion of the 728 commune granaries in Chaoan County. In Yunnan in the first half of 1961, some 240,000 tons were contaminated by vermin. In Chucheng County, Shandong, each kilo of grain was crawling with hundreds of insects. And then there was rot. Poor storage conditions contributed to it, as well as the practice, not always successfully detected by grain inspectors, of bulking up grain with water. In Guangdong, close to a third of 1.5 million tons of state grain contained too much water, so that one granary after another succumbed to rot. In Hunan, 1/5 of all grain in state granaries was either infested with insects